Again, it depends what you mean by agriculture. When we talk about agriculture, we think of fields of one crop. But domestication, plant domestication as a worldwide phenomenon, is not mainly about fields of one crop. In many areas of the world, it's very mixed, so that you get tubers and fruits of various sorts all together. And what people have done is use the resources of their landscape and concentrate them and make them more productive in various ways by cutting out the weeds that choke them, etc. So how do we draw a line between Aboriginal people harvesting tubers? And in order to harvest tubers, they have to dig the soil. And once they've dug the soil, that makes a better and better drained environment for the growth of the next season's tubers, if you leave a bit of this year's in place. Is that agriculture? Isn't it agriculture? Aboriginal people were harvesting yams, and they were harvesting them over big areas. Gray talks about going for 2 or 3 miles through the humps and hollows, which were the results of digging yams, and as far as he could see in both directions.
So you're definitely telling me that it was an altered landscape that Stirling would have seen when he came here in 1827 by human technology.
Well, only parts of it would be affected by digging for tubers, but a much more widespread effect, of course, was the effect of Aboriginal burning, and that again could be seen as a form of encouragement of the growth of pasture. You burnt off the old dry grasses, and as soon as the rains came, new ones would spring up, and this would be better areas for kangaroos, and of course better areas for sheep or cattle. Good pasture is good pasture. And also, if you'd burnt a smallish patch and fertilised that with the ash, not by doing anything, but simply by doing the burning, then where would you look for the roos? In that area. So you didn't need to put a fence around them. They came to you.
I've actually read some of the early explorers' accounts of seeing a really blackened, desolate country in that late summertime, February kind of time of the year, when the countryside did look pretty black and desolate. But I suppose within a few months, the rains of May have carpeted the whole place with some fresh pasture for the kangaroos. And the Noongar men go to work hunting kangaroos. Would that have been what would have happened?
Well, burning had a number of objectives or a number of outcomes. Burning early in the season was quite often to protect particular resources from later fires, which would be fiercer. You would protect the reed roots in the swamp by burning round the margins of the swamp as soon as it dried out sufficiently. When it dried out a bit more, you'd burn another circle, so that there was never a point at which a late season devastating fire burnt the entire reed roots out of that swamp and you couldn't harvest them. You would put a circle of burning early in the season round a clump of trees whose wood you wanted for spears. You would be very careful in burning early in the season to protect yam diggings that you wanted to harvest later. By late in the season, it didn't matter where the fire went. The really important bits had already been protected by early burning, and the rest was the wild country, the bush, which you didn't care about one way or the other.
So that would have been more down on the Swan Coastal Plain that you're talking about, and the area that they didn't care about maybe was the thicker Jarrah Forest in the Darling Ranges and the Karri Forest further south?
We have that sort of account for more recent studies in Arnhem Land, but nobody was doing that sort of ecological study here in the 1830s. But we certainly do get quite incidental accounts of widespread bushfire through the forest fairly late in the season. We also get accounts of people being able to move easily through valleys like the valley of the Wooraloo Brook, across into the tributaries of the Avon and over towards Toojay. And this clearly was a route which had been kept open by much more frequent burning each year, so that it never had a chance to regrow thickly. So keeping routes open, routeways open, protecting resources, these are among the objectives of burning, as well as encouraging later pasture growth and driving animals, either small creatures, as in the women's drives, or the large-scale kangaroo drives, which could only be done if you had a large gathering of people, and that was often associated with big gatherings and ceremonial occasions.
That's interesting. You talk about making a really accessible route between the Swan Coastal Plain and what we now call the Wheat Belt through the Avon Valley, through burning. Just a few weeks' time, there'll be the Avon Descent, and there'll be heaps of people up in that area. And I'm not sure how many of them will know that that was an ancient Noongar a route into the inland area.
The Avon Gorge is very narrow and doesn't provide a good route, whereas the Wooraloo Brook, which is actually east-west and practically parallel to it coming down to Walyanga, which is important in the Avon Descent, that's the major eastward route, and that's a wide, shallow valley, as distinct from the narrow, sharply incised at the foot of the scar.
So the most interesting idea for me in your book from the 70s on Noongar land use and the use of fire is basically to focus attention on the Noongar word kala. What does that mean?
George Fletcher Moore has an interesting series of meanings in his vocabulary. The basic meaning is fire. It can also mean hearth, and it's used in the sense of hearth and home. And by extension, it comes to mean property, and above all, property in land. Homeland is, I think, one of the meanings. Perhaps property isn't quite the right word, because there's responsibility for land also implied. And it's sometimes said that the Aborigines, that an Aboriginal group didn't so much own the land as the land owned the group. But there was this very close tie of use of resources and responsibility for making sure that those resources were preserved and enhanced.
then again, I was thinking about the way in which their firing country was concomitant with their home country, and that you certainly wouldn't talk about that in Western Europe. But do you think we can learn anything about using fire in today's Western Australia from Noongar land use 200 years ago?
I think that's a very controversial topic. It's very controversial for a start. What were the overall ecological effects of Aboriginal firing? Some people have seen these as ameliorating the environment, whether you're talking about this on a short time scale or whether you're talking about it on a long time scale. I think there's no doubt about it on the short time scale that it improved productivity for Aboriginal people. But I think there is doubt about it on the long time scale. And Duncan Merrilies, for instance, writing at the same time as Rhys Jones in the late 60s, saw the overall effects of Aboriginal burning over millennia as bad for the landscape, as part of the process which he called desertification, as responsible for the expansion of the centre, the arid centre of Australia, at the expense of the more humid margins. On the other hand, there are people like Horton who've said firing could not possibly have any major effect on the landscape at all. I would not take any of those simplistic views. I would not take the view of it improves necessarily, or it makes the landscape deteriorate, or that it has no effect. I think probably the short-term effect is improvement, and it may be that the long-term effect is deterioration.
Well, thanks very much, Sylvia Hallam.